There were, I think there were about 8 officers in there, and within 3 days only 2 of us were alive. We went to our various regiments. The shell fire, the artillery fire, as we approached the casino town in the Leary Valley, was so intense that the whole valley was as though it were sort of a white daylight. And it was practically continuous light while this went on. The noise was thunderous. We would have, in fact, driven right into German lines if a British MP hadn't stopped us somewhere along the line. We were that close to just disappearing into the night.
Keep on going north.
Yeah. Anyway, I rejoined the regiment, and the regiment, the cavalry tanks, had engaged in a very interesting project. The name of Tony Kingsmill, who was the light aid detachment of Remy, had, with the help of other people obviously, had taken the turret off a Sherman and put part of a Bailey Bridge on it on a set of rollers. And he led this tank along with another fellow whom I happen to know, Ian Seymour, who's still in Vancouver as a lawyer. They led this tank into the water. In fact, both of the men are over in Vancouver. And successfully got this bridge in place, using the Sherman tank in the middle of the river as the main support for it. It wasn't perfect, but it got a number of the Calgary tanks over. I believe it was the Calgary Regiment. Anyway, they had a very hard fight, lost a number of tanks and their crews, and I took over a rather shaken two tank crews and their tanks, and a new tank and crew, because we had then 3 tanks in the troop.
Which squadron was this?
I went at that time with, I'm just trying to think, because I was in every one ABC and headquarters, but it was B Squadron that I went with. We were promised, they were promised, a good layoff and a rest and a chance to work on the equipment a bit. And instead of that, they were flung right back into action. I pulled out with the rest. I didn't even know what the sound of an incoming shell and an outgoing shell was. It was dark when we pulled out, and I asked the driver or the loader operator, what was that? Well, theirs or ours? And this is how green you are, you know. The crew, I think, felt better when they saw me join. They're always concerned, who is the new officer going to be? Because they had seen their own officer brew up, that is, burn up, because he had mistaken a hill to be something that it wasn't, and the Germans were sitting on it instead of the clear hill, the safe hill that he should have been on. And they were a pretty shaky crew when you see your friends fry. So I think they were a bit relieved when a couple of them recognized me as an ex-sergeant, you know. That didn't make you all any better, but at least they knew you'd been around enough, maybe you'd listen to somebody instead of just saying, well, I know, you know. And we went over a bridge on the approach past the town of Casino, or the what left of it. And there was very little left. My tank, bless it, threw a track on a hairpin turn right at the end of the approach to the bridge, the fire approach. Here's a column stretching as far as your eye can see of the 8th British Army, and my own regiment's tanks proceeding on ahead, and I'm brand new. I've been with the regiment again in my tank troop for maybe 2 days. I've got a Sherman tank that's thrown a track out in front of it, thank goodness. So we're able to pull the tank up on the track, out of the way of the curve, and I grabbed my sleeping roll and with all my gear in it, pulled it on my, put it on the corporal's tank, and asked and told him to take over and join me when he could. We went up to the Aquino Airport, north and a little bit west of Casino, and on the 23rd of May, that would be 43, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting outside writing a nice torrid letter to my bride back in Canada, who I knew was expecting just literally before I left Canada, when there was a sudden flash, stars sort of, you know, the noise was so deafening, I guess, you saw stars, and blood all over the letter, and I looked at my hand, it was bleeding, and a couple of fellows on the ground groaning, and the other fellows dove under the tank where we had a little hole for safety. We were outside taking in a bit of sun and fresh air because the colonel had passed the word that we were getting the fellows, not myself, I was a newcomer, I didn't know enough, but the old timers were getting tank bound.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't leave their tanks, and this is bad for morale, it's bad for health and so on. So they were trying to get you to sit outside, but unfortunately the Germans caught half a dozen of us by surprise using a very high velocity, either a long-barreled 75 or an 88.
Mm-hmm.
And it came in and hit before you heard the whistle,
yeah.
You know. I wasn't all that badly wounded. I had a couple of hunks, which I still have in my shin, right shin, and I had these little pieces in my left hand and a couple of little bits in my hip. Now, what looked worst of all was I was wearing the metal-rimmed glasses,
mm-hmm.
which they use for anti-gas purposes, you know, so that your respirator wouldn't leak. And the concussion of the shell was so great that it had made my glasses jump and cut across the bridge of my nose.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever cut yourself there, you know, you'll bleed profusely.
Continuously.
Yeah, and so when I was running for help, and they were still shelling,
mm-hmm.
but one fellow was very badly wounded. I knew somebody had to go for aid, so, and I needed something.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran, and of course the shell was still landing in around the area, and all my fellow tankers looking out from under their tanks saying, oh, poor Maltby's had it. Look, he's been hit in the middle of the head, and he's gone berserk. When in fact, it was nothing more than a little sort of razor cut.
Mm-hmm.
But that was sort of an interesting thing, because when I got back, the shelling stopped, and I went back with the after they picked up my fellows, and I had my pistol on, and rounds of ammunition for the Smith & Wesson were very hard to get, extremely scarce, and I had my compass and my binoculars, and I said to myself, here's where I get some war souvenirs, you see, because if anything in a battle like that was lost, it was written off, and no questions asked. But when I first went to the first aid post, which is a British infantry regiment, because I never did support a Canadian in all my time in action. I had left up the east coast of Italy. The regiment had supported Canadian troops to a large extent, not entirely, but to a very large extent. And so they were well known to the Canadian troops, but by the time I came, it was always British Indian Division, Gurkhas, Poles, Free French,
mm-hmm.
You name it,
yeah,
and British.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But we got back to the next stage in the medical evacuation, and they had just been shelled. It was a big tent, marquee type tents with big red crosses on them, but they had been shelled. Some of the nurses were wounded or killed, and it was quite a shambles. And I got in there, and they stuck more morphine into you, and just in case. And I guess I must have been high, because a nurse came along, said hello or something, how are you, and all the rest. Do you have any arms or ammunition? I see, well, my plan had been at this time to say, oh, no, no, they were in the back, I left them with the tank.
Mm-hmm.
No questions would have been asked, because it wasn't a big machine gun or anything, you know. But no, I was so high, I just turned around and said, oh, sure, you'll find 12 rounds of ammunition. So I never have owned a gun. That was my closest I came to it. But anyway, I went back to Caserta, to 14 General Hospital. The 14 and 15 were together there. And there I wandered. I was walking. I was neglected, because I had carried on the back of my tank, I had a British officer's kit, which included a little bath.
Mm-hmm.
And the bath was a bit of canvas about 3.5 feet square, with things in the corner that you put on a little frame, and you'd get about a foot of water in the bottom, you know, or on your bottom, whichever you like. And I had just had a bath and shaved, and when I was hit, so I came back in, and all these poor, filthy infantry guys, you know, covered with stuff and with camouflage stuff on their face and all the rest. You know, I come in spanking clean, so they neglected me for about 2 days, and everybody assuming I'd been bathed and checked in. But I met a fellow by the name of E.E. Maltby, Ed Maltby, who was Signal Corps. I looked him up because of the name, and he later turned out to be our signals officer. He came up to the regiment. So, anyway, after that, in a very pleasant convalescence period, south of Naples, oh dear, was in a place that Mussolini had for a training center for the Mussolini youth movement. It'll come to me. Hospitals in Caserta, Salerno,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Where
the landing was. Beautiful beach, and they had cleared some of it of mines, were able to go into the sea. I had no effect from any of my wounds, except I couldn't squeeze my toothpaste with my left hand. So I was going around all day squeezing a sponge ball, and that was my therapy. But I then went back up through Avellino, Benevento, rejoined the regiment.
How long were you out altogether?
Oh, I'm guessing I must have been out about 6 weeks, I think. Yeah. By the time I went through the hospital, I wasn't in there very long, 10 days maybe, including the 2 days I just sat and waited for somebody to come and see me. And feeling very grateful, because I arrived in there on the 23rd, and the 24th was a big assault again on the next line. And I lost a lot of good friends there, and the fellows that came in, the fellow in the bed next to me, had his jeep had run over a landmine. He had no cheeks left on his bottom. He looked like, you know, somebody had sliced off the prime meat to roast. Fellows in there blinded, and some terribly burned, and, you know, I just felt so lucky that
It
wasn't even funny. During this period of time, there's a story I've got to tell you that's true. My fellow is dead now. His name was Danny Spittle. He was a character. He used to draw Donald Duck cartoons over everything and anything, about anything. And he got up. He was the other officer who lived beyond 3 days in the crew that went up to Casino with me. And he was subjected to attack by American fighter bombers, shelled by our own troops and the Germans. You know, little things happen like this in war. And he was getting pretty rattly when he was coming up over a hill. They were approaching the Melfa River, you know, where the Westminster CO one. Mahoney, was it? One of the EC there.
I can't recall his name.
He came up the top of a hill. I've heard the story so many times. When a flash from across the valley and a shell whistled over his head, and they realized there was either a German SP or Tiger tank over there. So he said, "Driver, reverse." Well, you know, this area is full of rolling hills in the valley there, Leary Valley, and it's lots of olive groves. And the olive trees are very tough trees. They've got real tough roots because they're usually in countries where you have to go deep to get any moisture. And as they reversed a foot or two, they backed right up into one of these olive trees. And they tried bunting it, and every time they went up to get a run at the thing, another shell would come closer to his head, you know, because he was sitting with his turret up above all this. And finally, he crawled down through into the driver's area where there was an escape hatch, got out underneath, took his hatchet with him, and chopped the tree down so they could back up. I think it was very shortly after that they sent him out for a little bit of battle fatigue. Exactly. Cuckoo, cuckoo.
Oh, dear. That's when you know you're getting desperate, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I rejoined the regiment. They had pushed on up past Rome and through the wheat fields and so on, and they were up at a place called Monte Sansovino near Arezzo. Arezzo is a very nice big town south of Florence, south and east, and on the railway. We're billeted there again. It is strange. Here we were billeted, and I was sleeping in a nice clean bed with a lovely doctor and his wife, and whom I kept in contact constantly until both of them died. In fact, we went back and visited the doctor when he was about 85 and still practicing medicine. And I went to bed the first night, I remember, and I was wakened with a terrible bang. Turned out that some Americans with what the artillery piece we used to call a long tom, very large, I don't know if it was 155 millimeter.
Yeah, I think it was 155.
Yeah, had come into the draw immediately behind this house. This house was on the edge of a nice steep hill with a good commanding view of the area, and the Germans were up about 5 miles up ahead, and we would pull back here at the infantry request because they were getting bad casualties every time a tank would come along.
Mm-hmm.
We would draw a fire. And you'd have a nice sleep and then maybe get up quite early, probably, and rumble away with your troop of tanks and get into position, first light, and plaster some poor bunch of Germans there that were just getting ready to have their breakfast. That was one time we used our phosphorus shells, not for smoke, but as a chemical weapon. We would punch a hole with the HE and with a high explosive and with the armor piercing, HEAP is what we used, and with a delayed fuse, and you'd go through into the house, and then our gunners were so good, they could put a shell right in behind that with the phosphorus, and then as they came out, you'd machine gun and shell them. It was a real nice game to play. Then you'd rumble back out before the artillery could get a bead on you, leave that for the infantry to worry about,
mm-hmm.
and have breakfast with your friends back in the town.
It
was the only time we did that in the war.
You used very much white phosphorus at this point? That must
have no.
Been something new coming.
No, that was something fairly new.
Yeah.
We had another interesting occasion. Well, that was a bit later. Anyway, we then pushed on up to a ridge overlooking the Arno River, and we could see from some parts of it, could vaguely see the spires of some of the churches in Florence. It was over to the west of us. The ridge had recently been evacuated by German troops. We had always there were some myths about every national group, and one of some of the myths of the Germans were their rigidity to plans, their ability to organize anything, and their cleanliness. We took over this ridge. It was covered with defecation, otherwise known as shit. In fact, we called it Shit Ridge. And it was surprising. We were surprised that German troops would live in such a condition. I don't know to what extent it was true. We were told that, well, these really weren't German troops. They were Poles forced into the German army, you see. I don't know what it was, but it was a very unmilitary, unhygienic area.
Well, I gather some of the German units at this point, some of them were still in good shape, but some of them were suffering very poorly, morale.
I think they were beginning to realize things weren't quite what had been originally painted for them. We then pushed up towards the Apennine Mountains. We crossed the Arno River without any opposition at the point where we went. You know that there was an arrangement between the Allies and the Germans that there would be no fighting in Florence proper.
Mm-hmm.
The Allies, you know the story about them, they allowed the Germans time to demolish completely the approaches to the Ponte Vecchio, which is the only bridge they left standing, because it was an ancient monument, really, and very interesting. And they then withdrew how many miles, 10 miles north of the Arno River and into the mountains. And that's where we next hit the Germans. We were supporting Indian troops then. I'm not sure which of the 4th or 11th British Indian Division. And the Germans were on a very high ridge. And we acted there as artillery, really. We were doing semi-indirect fire. It was too far to fire over our sights, but using azimuth and sort of level, I've forgotten the name of the instrument we used, we were able to fire quite accurately, still with our short barrel 75 millimeter, but it had a good explosive shell, and with our rapid fire capability, it was quite effective. And it was like watching a movie in this case, because you could see where your shells were landing. You knew, you were told that that's where the Germans were, and you could see the Indian troops moving up as you, through your binoculars, you could actually see it. And then, of course, we were told to cease fire.
Mm-hmm.
We'd hit them. There was, in those valleys north of Florence, there was one occasion when I was being fired upon by German artillery, mortars, doesn't matter what. We were not, we couldn't go any further at this time, and we were stuck in being subjected to rather heavy shell fire, and that's going to cause casualties in time. So I called for artillery fire. We had at that time the Sussex and Surrey Yeomanry were self-propelled British artillery unit, had been with us for a number of months and got new as well. I called for smoke and I gave them the coordinates where the fire was suspected to be coming from, and they knew the wind direction and so on. It didn't take long after that when there were some puffs in the sky, puff, 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 and there were millions, it looked like millions of little white things floating through the air. Well, it wasn't smoke, they were propaganda leaflets. And I was told afterwards that the colored marking for the two were identical, or so close that they didn't know they'd been given the wrong thing for smoke. But you know, the important thing about it was that the firing stopped.
Probably confused the Germans.
Well, it did, and furthermore, that night I believe there were some six Germans came in with the safe passage surrender leaflets. And I used that little story when I went to Staff College in 55 in one of our impromptu lectures. In fact, I still had one of the leaflets. It was such a remarkable thing to have happened. And I let it go and flutter down from my hand to the floor of the stage. And I said, "This gentleman proves that the pen is mightier than the sword." I got about a B+ for that one. But it was. Then we went into the Apennines, and that was a different campaign again, because the mountains were very close and high. Winter was upon us. We were sleeping outside, sometimes inside. We spent quite a time around a town called Maradi. I still have the school flag from Maradi. I guess someday I'll give it to the regiment and put them up in the, for what it's worth. There we had an incident where we were faced with a, for the first and only time, with a railway gun. And it was a whopper. I don't know what size of shell it was firing. Maradi was a railway junction point, a marshaling yard, which they changed the trains around and added engines to take them over and through the Apennines. And of course, this was a good place for a marshaling area for truck supplies and so on. And this gun would come out and take pot shots at this area and the town and wherever there was major action. That valley contained a number of interesting incidents. One was when a British brigadier came up, and I was at this time in the forward position with the infantry, with my tanks behind and in sheds and houses and anywhere you could be concealed. And he wanted to know what I thought about making a tank charge up that slope over there. Well, that slope over there looked nice and broad and easy from a mile or two, couple miles away. But I'd been up over, half a mile up towards the enemy lines by foot. And I knew how many ditches and road cuttings there were, and how many streams there were. In other words, tank obstacles. And I said, "There's not going to be any dash up those hills." So the tanks can't dash over those kind of obstacles. But again, perhaps because he was British, I don't know, but he also had a chat with my CO that I got the message back in a hurry, "For God's sake, let's not have this nonsense. You know, we've gone this far and still alive, let's not throw it away." The plan was canceled. Incidents happened in that valley. I went up to the forward observation post of the artillery in our area, which was, everything was sort of exposed there because there were the Germans were up in the high hills watching us. Everything we did, they could see, any, even a person moving. And it wasn't heavily wooded. There was, the most you could get was an orchard of olive orchards. And I threaded my way, doing my best Indian infantry tactics to get up. And I saw what I wanted to see, which was where we were going to make an attack. Or it was actually a feint, while something else went along the other side. As I started back, I was about 500 yards from the safety of the old pit, or relative safety, which I didn't want to give away. And so I'd taken as circuitous a route as I could. And I was in fairly exposed area when I heard this mortar shell coming at me. So I went flat in my face, and boom, it was short. And I got up so fast, I think the shrapnel or the shell fragments were still whizzing around. Ran, this happened, they must have taken at least four shots at me before I came to the edge of the road, which is a cut-in road because of the side of the hill, and my sergeant and corporal were standing there. My corporal just lives in Maple Ridge now, Pete Venables. They were standing there laughing like cranes. And I took the last one I heard, and I just took one big jump. I think I must have jumped 12 broad feet and down into the where they were, which is relatively safe. You'd have to have almost a direct hit to get you. And then that day, two troops of tanks, one run by this Danny Spittlefellow, was on the left in the low ground near the river. And I was sort of along the higher ground that I'd been chased with this mortar. And the Dan got into position to fire when this railway gun opened up on his tank, or in his troops area. Well, it sounded like a freight car coming through the air from where I was in relation to its flight. And this huge blast and a huge pile of dirt going up in the air. Dan, it must have fired about four shots before finally we called off the action and beetled back. But he would shift, would come behind him, and he'd shift over to his left, and it would come just about where he was, and he'd shift forward a bit. About four times he shifted around.
Yeah.
He was, no wonder he was a little bit rattled.
I think so, yeah.
That was the same area when came Christmas time. We were, things really bogged down. It was cold and damp, and a lot of shoe mines, a couple of fellows lost their legs or feet.
Those were the little wooden ones.
Yes,
little
tiny ones, and they, wicked things, you couldn't see them, were hard to detect, made of wood, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to go off where we could be sheltered from the artillery fire into a little village. I had a church there. The only way to get there, though, we had to go over a railway trestle. And I can tell you that's a bit of a thrill, to get on a railway trestle, which has a good drop down into the river valley, and your tank tracks on each side of the train tracks, and overlapping the ties by an inch or two on each side. That was quite an incident. And then then we got the move to go back to Florence. And we got turned out we were going to go back to Arezzo and up the east coast and come out and join the Canadian forces who were on the flats of the Po Valley near Bagnacavallo. Anyway, before we got there, we had to get back out of the Apennines, and the road was very bad. It was icy, and there had been cave-ins and so on. There were times there when our tanks would go along the highway, and the highway had been reconstructed and rebuilt by engineers, and it was sometimes sloping the wrong way toward the edge, and the tanks would go 2 feet forward and about 6 inches towards the edge, and then another couple of, this wasn't all the way through the highway, but in the bad spots, it was very bad. And, boy, I can tell you, sitting up on the turret with the rest of your crew outside trying to break frozen dirt or pebbles, anything, get something under the track to give a little traction. And the driver down there, perhaps if you went over, the crew commander might have been able to jump. The driver, no hope at all. And there you are, coaxing him along, steady, right, okay, you know. And we got over there. When we got back into our harbor in south of Florence, Axis Sal came on. "Congratulations to the Calgary tanks for your marvelous feat of motorized movement and your move back from the Marradi to Florence." You know, really great for the morale. Yeah.
How was the resistance pretty stiff when you ran up against the Germans? Did they fight pretty hard?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Their morale pretty good for the most
part? Whenever I met them, they were shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, one time I was shooting at the Ontario tanks, too.
Is
that right? Oh, yeah, you get mixed up in those hills there, and you don't know. All you know is that there's a shot from over there, and it's landing here. You don't know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we had quite a little firefight one time, until finally somebody back at brigade headquarters twigged on to the fact that the Calgarys and the Ontarios were having a little fight. Fortunately, nobody got hurt. But we moved up near Bagnacavallo, and we took over a position at the Desert Rat. No. We took over a position on behind the dikes on this river that runs through Bagnacavallo, down from Maradi and so on. Our regiment was quite unique in many ways. We had, for example, our own farm. Again, the farm influence. We had really, instead of the A, B, and C echelon, we had A, B, C in the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually would pick up live animals, whether they're edible or not. If they weren't edible, they were tradable.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't eat a donkey, but you could trade it.
Yeah.
And we saved these animals from exhaustion and maybe walking on mines and
mm-hmm.
being stolen by people that had no right to steal them. So we saved them and
mm-hmm.
and used them. That meant that you had to know where there was feed for them,
mm-hmm.
you know. So part of our SITREP, or situation report, each day would include enemy aircraft, bombing, shelling, infant movements, you know, your own activities. Plus, if you found some feed for various types, and these fellows knew the various kinds of feed, and this would go back saying we have 5 tons of number 4 oats or something, and map reference something or other. Up the next night would come a bunch of jeeps and trailers, and we'd load on the stuff, and back would go beyond our B echelon to where we kept our reserve. And so we ate better than most. But also, in addition to that, we used to always draw the ammunition that we were allowed. With the result, by the time we got to Bagnacavallo, we had a surplus. And so we used to go up every night and fire point blank at the Germans that were dug in on the our side of the river, which was heavily diked. And every day there would be a truce period while they carried out their wounded and dead and so on. This went on for 2, 3, 4 days, and we were equipped at this time with an extension to our tracks, which they called platypus. Each track link had these things put on, and it meant it added to the, reduced your ground weight per square inch, so that you could go over this very boggy country. The day I was to go, the night I was to go, was the night we were pulled out of there and the Desert Rats took over. And we heard later that they lost 3 tanks that night, trying the same trick.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason was they had, Germans had moved up some tanks, I don't know whether they were Tigers or what, from Bologna, where Matt Clark was threatening them, but not very much. And we were causing more damage.
Yeah.
And our colonel got in trouble about all this shooting. How can he shoot so many rounds in a day when you're only allowed 2 rounds a tank per day? You see, and then it came out where we had our little extra reserve we carried. And not supposed to do that. Well, anyway, we were pulled out of there, went back to Leghorn, got on board American landing craft, and went over to Marseille. I was left with the job of taking the tanks up the Rhone Valley on flatbeds. And talking about that, there was one time moving up to from the Rezzo, no, moving back from the front. The whole regiment was in danger of being asphyxiated in a tunnel. The train, these were coal-type trains, could barely pull us up the grade through this tunnel, and we very nearly, we were just black when we got out of that tunnel, and some fellows were just about ready to pass out from the fumes and so on. But we went up to a little town called Dottigny in Belgium, which is near a town called either Courtrai or Kortrijk, whether it's Flemish or French. And,
this would have been, what, right at the end of 1944?
Yeah. We were given new tanks then with the long barrel, choke barrel, 76s.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an awful bark. So we had to fire these in. And so we went down to Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans were still hanging on there. And it was surrounded by I think it was the Czechs or Poles. And just to contain them, they figured it would cost too many lives to try to take the city, and they didn't need it by then. We went into the firing ranges there. I very nearly got killed twice there, but I was walking. I was to be one of the fire direction officers for the training exercise, and walking up the road, and the Germans started to shell the place. I was just about to dive into the ditch, which is the natural place to go, and this Czech soldier, I think it was, yelled out, "Achtung, Minen, Minen!"
Mm-hmm.
So I just flopped on the road. We hadn't cleared the verges. But, so I can say I fought at Dunkirk, too.
On the other end.
Yeah. Wrong time.
So you just went over and emptied a few rounds into Dunkirk?
Oh, yes, fire? Yeah. It was controlled firing, and we were what they call TNAing our sights, and making sure that what you're aiming at was what you're going to hit,
mm-hmm.
if your gunner was following directions. Then we moved up, went through a little part of Germany, the northern part of the part in the east side, the west side of the Rhine, Hochwald area.
Mm-hmm.
But we were just going by tank transporter then. Got up to Nijmegen and Arnhem. And we dug in the other side of Arnhem, which was still held by the Germans. We had exercise Pepperpot. And we dug in there, expecting to be shelled. And it was the first time I got under the tank, and after a little bit, each of us looked at the other, wondering who had peed their bed. It turned out it was the Dutch practice of using human manure. Stuff had filtered through down into the ground. Here we had our noses up against it. But we fired practically all night. The hottest I've ever felt a tank main weapon. Rockets. Anybody that had anything that would get across the river was firing. Then the next day they put pontoon bridges across and took the town with relatively little resistance. Moved in, and we swapped our piano we brought from Italy, which it wasn't supposed to come, but the fellows had, against instructions from me and the CO, I was the regimental piano player, and I said, "Let's get rid of the piano." Instead of that, they unloaded some ammunition from an ammunition truck, put the piano right in the smack in the middle, and it weighed about the same. The Americans were checking for extra caravans and headquarters vehicles. Anyway, we found a piano with a leg chopped off. It was brand new. So we left our old Italian piano in the shop in the middle of Arnhem, took the new piano, fixed the leg, of course, and had that until the end of the war. Now, I'm just wondering what the piano owner, the owner of this shop, when he came back, if he found this old Italian piano there, where the dickens did it come from? But we were very honest that way. That was quite a sight. All the litter of the paratroopers drop was around there.
It hadn't been that long before, really,
And we made an approach march through the quite forest area from Arnhem to Ede and towards Utrecht. And I guess I was the lead troop there, and we were supporting the London Brigade this time. They'd never been with tanks that fought so closely with infantry as we had learned to do in Italy. And moving up there, I had a bunch of infantry on the back of my tank when they started to be fired upon. It was the Moorish area, wide flat through the scrub and brush. And these Germans standing up and firing their Schmeissers at them. So I wouldn't normally, if they had stood up and put their hands up, they would have been taken prisoner. But as it was, I just directed the machine gun fire on them and I guess wiped them out. And we carried on into towards Utrecht. We'd had breakfast given to us at 3 a.m, and this was now about 5 or 6, and I was getting hungry, so I had a sandwich in my hand when going through this reforested area, and I sitting half out of my turret, and a branch caught on the gun, and then swept back across my face and swept my sandwich out of my hand. Well, that little incident is the only time I made Vancouver newspaper headline, I think. I still have the article. Local officer loses sandwich or something. Yeah. So this is my hometown.
Not exactly the best way to be.
No, my PR wasn't very good.
No.
We went into the barracks on the outside of Utrecht there. As we approached it, there was a moor this way, and our tanks were up on the 90 degrees angle, providing fire. I had reported hearing diesel engines, heavy diesel engines, start up and move away. So we knew there were SPs or tanks around. I'd seen a German DR, dispatch rider or scout on a motorcycle. We were up behind on a high piece of ground over a cut road, and he was down below. And I spotted from my height, I could see his helmet. And he was trying to get his motorcycle going to bring back the latest news. These tanks, they were coming in on them. Couldn't get it going. I tried machine gun, actually, it's the first thing. It jammed. This was a new tank that had just come up, and with a fellow who'd never been in action before, very good gunner, but the guns weren't properly looked after. Jammed. We'll try an HE. We didn't want to try high explosives because it would blow the heads off the infantry right above them.